Greetings, Hempster. Thank you for listening in to another Hempisode of Hempaware Radio. This is Tyler Hemp, your Hemptrepreneurial host, here to empower your Hempisphere because it's important. Hemp entrepreneurs and hemp companies around the world struggle to market and sell their products effectively, but it doesn't have to be that way. At Hempaware, we provide strategic marketing and branding services so that hemp entrepreneurs just like you can transform the world with your hemp products and services and transform the planet in a way that supports all of life. So if you're struggling to get traffic to your website or convert that traffic into ongoing sales, or if you're needing help with your website, marketing, or branding in any way, visit hempaware.com and check out some of the valuable resources that we've put together for hemp entrepreneurs and companies just like yours. On today's show, I'm honored to have a longtime buddy and one of the OG hempsters. His name is Ron Alkalay. I like to call him Ronnie. And he is the creator of a lifestyle and hemp clothing brand called Vital Hemp, based out of Southern California. And their mission is to introduce people to the superior qualities of hemp by producing the most comfortable, healthy, and truly eco-friendly clothing on the planet. As a vital member of the sustainable business community, they were part of the groundswell that changed the antiquated laws re-legalizing the cultivation of industrial hemp in the USA so that we can all benefit from the myriad uses of this amazing plant, from food, plastics, clothing, paper, energy, fuel, medicine, and so much more. Vital Hemp introduces people to the superior qualities of hemp by producing the most comfortable, healthy, and sustainable hemp clothes possible. Hemp has come a long way, and so has Vital Hemp. From their first weekend stand on the Venice Boardwalk in 2003 to their journeys up and down the West Coast to green festivals in Denver and DC and back to Sedona, Joshua Tree, and their old shop on Main Street in Santa Monica. All I can say is wow, and express my gratitude for Ronnie for being such an inspiration for so many people and for making this world a greener, more sustainable, and hempy place. So, Hempster, as you very well know, it's been far too long since hemp was known for what it really is, an essential solution for food, homes, clothing, plastics, energy, medicine, and fuel, and so much more. So if you're ready to take your hemp game to the next level and learn some things about how you can do better with your hemp business, then you're going to love this hempisode. So with that said, I'd like to welcome my good buddy and longtime hempster, Ronnie Alkalay, to the show. Thank you so much for joining me on this Hempisode. I appreciate you being here, brother.
Thank you, Tyler. Thanks so much. It's always good to see your face. It warms my heart.
Right on. And you know, we've known each other, gosh, I think probably close to 18 years. You've been doing this over 20 years now. But I don't think I have ever asked you, what did you do before you got into hemp and before you created your own hemp company with Vital Hemp? What is your background? What is your expertise?
Sure. Well, I was the eldest son of two Jewish immigrants. My father from Bulgaria, he was a quantum physicist. My mother from Mexico, from Polish ancestry, and they met on a blind date here in LA. I was kind of a straight son until I started smoking weed in the summer between 7th and 8th grade and grew little plants in the, just beyond the backyard, which my brother saw me doing and ratted me out to my mom. And even though I told him it was a science experiment, and he'd like, Mom, what's Ronnie's science experiment? But anyway, so they weren't too pleased. And they basically sent me to an all-boys prep school called the Harvard School, now Harvard Westlake. And from there, I went to Brown, and I did all the things that, you know, the eldest son is supposed to do. I graduated magna cum laude, a double degree, and then I went to graduate school. Well, I thought I'd be a lawyer, but I ended up working in a law firm and realizing that wasn't for me and that it would kill my soul. I knew I was a writer from probably 8th grade. I decided to go into a master's and PhD program at Berkeley, with master's in creative writing and PhD in English and American literature. My idea was that I hadn't really, even though I was one of my majors in college was comp lit, I felt like I hadn't read enough novels. And I really wanted to become an expert in writing stories. And I felt that the only way to do that was to consume more stories. So I did my master's in creative writing, my PhD in English and American literature. It took 10 years. Along the way, I taught 6 of those years at Berkeley. I developed an expertise in teaching writing and also in the literature of the 19th to 20th century in America in the U.S. So I focused on post-World War II fiction and film. I also taught film history for many years. So at Berkeley, at San Francisco State, I lectured in the film history department there and in the film department. And then I moved down here. I worked in the film industry. My idea was to help the industry tell better stories and work a few jobs in the entertainment world until I got hired to write 2 screenplays. And then I went back to teaching at AFI, later at Loyola, with 3.5-year stint working as a grant writer for the Children's Nature Institute, which is a nonprofit that served about 20,000 kids and parents and teachers everywhere, bringing them out from the poorest neighborhoods of Los Angeles, landlocked neighborhoods. We would rent buses. We had trained walk leaders who went through a week-long training program on how to provide interactive, multi-sensory nature experiences to the youngest children from pre-K to third grade, when kids' minds are really developing and when their attitudes are forming. And I learned so much about how important being exposed to nature can be. I took it for granted because I grew up on the wild edge of LA, Pacific Palisades, that a lot of these kids have never even seen the beach or walked on uneven ground. And those experiences form neural networks in the brains of kids, which are super important. And also combined with the lesson plans where we pretended we were trees or birds and sang songs and smelled things and interacted with nature, you know, their impulse was if they see ants, they just want to kill them. And we would say, no, you know, this is their home. How would you like it if a big giant came and stomped on you in your home? And so, you know, developing empathy for these kids so that they started to see that every species had a place and a function in this world, and to have developed feelings of respect and responsibility for the natural world, because we're intertwined and the fate of humans is intertwined with the fate of other species. So my expertise, I did some stints with a professional writer, writing screenplays, music video treatments, commercial treatments, you name it, I wrote it. And I'm still doing that. I just this morning wrote a holiday newsletter for the largest post-production company in town. And I really enjoy using my skills as a wordsmith to help other companies, particularly aligned companies, achieve their goals, whether internally or externally. And I'm doing more of that these days. Vital Hemp is still going. I have ideas for new products that I want to bring to market. And that's my background.
That's beautiful. I mean, you have done a lot in your life, and I didn't realize you had a PhD in American literature and taught at Berkeley. I mean, that's super pertinent information that all these years I didn't know about you. And it totally makes sense with, you know, the kind-hearted human being that you are, that you worked with kids and taught them empathy, connecting with nature. It's totally on point with who I want you to be. So tell me, like, the moment or the revelation that you had, like, I'm going to create a hemp company. You could have been a lawyer. You could have gone into, you know, other fields, like you said. But for some reason, you're like, I got to create this hemp clothing company. Why did you, what was that moment like for you? Or when did you have that epiphany?
Yeah. Well, I think there were several epiphanies along the way. The first was on a road trip north to bid farewell to my friend Lincoln Schwensky. He finally got his PhD at Berkeley after 13 years. I had bought him a Swatch as a going away present. He was going to the University of Alabama in Mobile to teach English and Hebraic studies, which I always think that's kind of funny. Hebraic studies and in Mobile, Alabama. And I bought him a Swatch to remind him of the value of time. But on the way up north, I stopped in San Luis Obispo to get a bite and saw this place called the Hemp Shack. And it was the first time I had ever seen a hemp store before. I went in and there were some beautiful clothes. And I remember feeling the hemp linen shirts and thinking, you know, this feels like it was made from plants. And it was the first time in my mind that I connected the idea that clothes can be made from plants, that when we're walking, even that when we're walking around in our cotton, it's actually comes from the earth. It's plant matter. But with the hemp, because of the nature of the linen and the long fibers, it was really clear to me that this was like walking around wearing plants. And when I tried it on, it felt that there was this kind of, instead of being a barrier between me and the world, I felt that it was a permeable barrier, like that my skin could breathe through the fabric, the world could breathe through the fabric into me. And it felt much more natural, and I felt more alive wearing it. So that was maybe my first experience. I bought Lincoln a sea salt gray banded collared shirt by a company called Juice Natural. But by the time I got to Berkeley, I had fallen so in love with the shirt, but I ended up giving him the Swatch and keeping the shirt for myself. Maybe a month later, I'm down in LA. I went to a yoga expo in the expo center, and I see a guy selling some closeout merchandise of clothing and things. And so there's some hemp pieces. And I said, hey, do you know where I can get any more clothes by this company called Juice Natural? He said, oh yeah, it's a long story, but they were the leaders in the high-end hemp clothing business in the 90s, and they divorced and they dissolved the company. So, well, do you know where I might get some closeouts? And so, yeah, you know, there's this guy named Jeff. He opened a hemp store just off the Windward Circle, and I think he bought all their closeout stuff. I said, oh, well, that's cool. That's not far from where I live. So, at the time, I was lecturing in film history at Loyola Marymount. So I went down there after lecture, and I saw this parody of a hemp store, you know, with the plastic marijuana leaves around the perimeter and the obligatory picture of Bob Marley, and it smelled thick with with cannabis smoke. And,
oh, okay.
And the stoned owner was behind their glass case with the bongs. And yet there were these beautiful clothes of all this different colors of Juice Natural clothing all around the store. So I bought some things and I'll return the next day, very excited, and bought more things. And I signed his guest his email list, and I made some comment like, this stuff's so great, I just have this fantasy of sharing it with the world. So about a week later, I'm in my flat in Los Feliz, and I'm preparing a lecture on Francois Truffaut or Italian neorealism, I forget which one, on my Zenith laptop with the green little letters tell you when it was. It was 2002, actually. And I get this email, and it's just like a one-line email from this guy. It says, I'd like to discuss the possibility of going into the hemp business with you. So here I was, an academic, and suddenly I get this email, and I remember going into one of those moments where I just looked up and to the right, and I think my eyes were open, but this whole potential future sort of unrolled like a movie in front of me, one that I had never seen before. And it was interesting. I was like, wow, could I do this? At the time I was lecturing, I just felt I'd seen An Inconvenient Truth, and I felt like, there's more that this world wants from me than to be standing on a podium, in front of 125 film majors, and lecturing about the creative achievements of mostly dead white men. I think that this world needs me to do more and to fight for healthy environments and healthy ecosystems. And so in this moment, they kind of had a vision that could be possible to have clothing. So I said, I wrote back and I said, yeah, let's meet. And so we met and he said, I want to start a hemp clothing, a wholesale hemp clothing company. And he said, what do you think we'd need? I said, well, I think we need a name and a website. We might need a partnership agreement to figure out our roles and responsibilities. I might like an LLC to protect my meager assets. And he says, oh, you know so much, I'll give you half. And I thought, well, I don't know about that. Well, let me think about this. So I talked with a couple of friends who had gone to Brown and got on to Wharton Business School and were, you know, successful business people. And I said, what do you think about this? And they said, well, be careful who you get into partnership with, because a partnership's like a marriage. And you got to know that you can trust the person and that you can communicate with the person and that you like the business because you're going to be spending a lot of time with them. I said, well, how do I know that? I just met the guy. And they said, well, do something small with him first just to test the waters. And I said, oh, that's a good idea. So I went back to him and I said, look, I spoke with my friends. They gave me some good advice. Is there anything small that we can do together just to see if we try to get along? And he said, well, there's this green festival up in San Francisco. I said, perfect. San Francisco, we could stay with my friends in Oakland. I'll work the booth with you. I don't even want to get paid. I just want to see if I like it. And so we met up there. He showed up smelling like a homeless guy. My friend gives me the bottle of Dr. Bronner's and says, hey, please give this to your friend. Ask him to take a shower. All right. Like, Jeff, you smell like you've been marinating in your own urine for hours. Oh, sorry. So he took a shower. The next morning we get up, we drive the U-Haul across the Bay Bridge towards San Francisco. Pop, pop, pop. He literally runs out of gas. He's like, oh, I forgot to fill up. I'm like, dude, quick, put in the neutral. Roll up the windows, turn off the radio, get in the right lanes. And we like cruised over that last bump on the Bay Bridge. And I knew where to get off on that first exit. And I knew where the 76 station was. So we like put, I ran there. We got one of those gas things. We made it and we sold. We set up the booth and I worked the booth and we sold a couple thousand dollars worth of stuff. And I felt great because I met the members of the green business community, the, you know, fair trade chocolatiers and the solar nuts and the health, the superfood geeks and all of these people who later became my close friends. And I thought I felt more at home in their company than I ever had among my supremely intelligent academic friends, because they were on mission that it was more than just heady. It was really from the heart, and it was more than just ivory tower. It was really in the world and here to be of service for the future of life on Earth. And that was how I saw myself.
So did you go into business with Jeff?
I did. We drove home together. We talked about our vision for a company. We both wanted to bring hemp back to the masses. And I said, yeah, like the Gap of hemp. And, you know, we wanted to do stylish basics. So we came home. I copied a 2-page partnership agreement from the back of a Nolo Press book I found at the library. And we were partners for about 3 months until he kind of, at the time I met him, I learned he had a 3-way notice for his shop. I talked with the landlord. I kind of got him out of a jam. I invested some money. I started opening accounts in Northern California in the desert on Melrose. And, you know, he kind of got back on his feet. And then we ordered a second shipment. We sold through the first shipment. And then he ordered a second shipment. And I learned that he had ordered some fabric without telling me. And the second shipment came with a name that we hadn't discussed. And I'm like, what's this for hemp thing? And he said, oh, well, I just had some extra labels. I'm like, what about, I thought we were going to do vital hemptations. He says, oh, no. Well, I had these extra. I'm like, yeah. So he said, well, and then he's kind of, he wasn't communicating well. And I said, look, just tell me what's going on. And he said, well, I want to do 4 hemp separately. And he said, well, listen, I don't have our agreement in front of me, but I think there's something called a non-compete clause. Why would I be in business with you if you're going to be running a competing business? And he said, well, then I'll buy you out. And I said, I don't want to be bought out. I'm in this. And he said, well, then let's just divide up the clothes and terminate the partnership. Like, really? Can't we just do different brands for different sectors? Like, you know, the Gap has Old Navy and Banana Republic. And so, no, I want to do this. I'm like, all right. So it was like one for you, one for me, one for you, one for me, one for you. And I had 40 boxes of hemp clothes in my garage in Los Feliz. No experience in the clothing business. And I was like, what am I going to do? What am I doing? So I called my friend Greg Wendt, who was a sustainable guy. And I said, what do I do? He said, well, why don't you talk to my friend Casey? She's producing the first Earth Day on the promenade. And I think it's going on in about a week. This was in April. I said, great. I called Casey. She said, yes, sir. Just bring a check for $125. This was in April of 2003. Just goes to show you how much booths cost back then. $125 for a 10 by 10. I mean, later I would spend, you know, $8,000 or more at the Natural Products Expo for the same size booth and for not make that much more. But anyway, so I was like, okay, I got a week. So I put an ad for a man with a van to help me take the stuff down. I painted a sign of the logo on some hemp cloth. I went downtown. I bought some used racks and used hangers and basically set up a booth. It was a one-day event. And, you know, I sold about $1,000 to that guy from the closeout booth. That the name was Howard. He had had a hemp store on the boardwalk in the 90s. He walks by and he says, oh, look at you. What are you doing? I thought you were partners with Jeff. He said, I said, yeah, we terminated. He said, oh, so what are you going to do now? I said, I have no idea. He said, oh, well, why don't you come down to the boardwalk? I'll help you out. I know a guy and he can rent you a spot. So I went down the next day and I met this guy and he shows me this little closet, you know, in a terrible part of the boardwalk. And he says, and you could put all your inventory here under this building. And I'm thinking like, yeah, and it'll be gone the next morning. And so I just said, yeah, I'll get back to you. So I called him. I literally called him back 10 minutes later. I said, I think I'm going to pass. I walked to the top end of the boardwalk, turned around, started walking really slowly, just vibing. Like, I'm going to set up on the free side of the boardwalk. And I got to this place just south of Fig Trees, and it just felt right. And I look up. And there's a guy named Dave, and he's straddling a bike. And he's like, hey, Ron. And then Dave had worked for Jeff. And I said, hey, Dave, what are you doing? And he's standing underneath an empty half of a 10 by 20 foot booth. And I said, I'm just looking for a place to set up my, you know, to sell hemp clothing. And he says, oh, yeah, I heard you and Jeff parted. Guy's a jerk. He borrowed my van and blew out the transmission. And he, you know, not pay me back. So I'm leaving town. I'm going back to Vegas. He's like, you want to buy my half the booth? I said, how much? He said, $50. I said, oh, well, let me check. And I looked in my wallet. I actually had a $50 bill. I handed it to him. And he took it. And he said, well, wait, hold on a minute. I share the booth with Marianne, who was in the other 10 by 10. And there's this like white Rastafarian woman, like with selling white Ethiopian clothes. And she looks up and he says, hey, Marianne, this is Ron. He's a cool guy. He wants to sell hemp clothing out of this side of the booth. Is that okay with you? And she looks up at me and she goes, yeah, he looks pretty cool. Okay. So he takes the 50, he says, and I'll come back tomorrow and help you set up. So that's began my, you know, 2-year adventure on weekends on the Venice boardwalk.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Man, so you've been doing this. I mean, that was way back in 2003. So that's, you know, 20 years ago. What has the transformation been like for you in terms of people being open and receptive to hemp? I mean, obviously being in Venice, I'm sure from the very beginning you had people that were gung-ho about what you had to offer. But I'm sure you've encountered the people asking if they can smoke your clothing and just the overall, the negative perception of hemp being cannabis. What has your experience been seeing the transformation over these years?
Well, yeah, I haven't experienced too much outright negativity. I've experienced a bunch of stereotypes. You know, I created the term hempeducation, and on the back of all my hang tags and business cards, I have several facts of hempeducation, mostly gleaned from the Emperor Wears No Clout no clothes. And anyway, so when people would say, hey, if I wear out my clothes, can I smoke them? I would say, well, hemp won't get you high, but wearing the clothes will raise your spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with little slogans that were designed to sort of counteract some of the
stigma,
negative stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you were around. A big inspiration for me in that way, because like you, I consider myself a wordsmith, and I love the power of words. And so I created something called the Hempsicon, which is a hemp lexicon.
Yeah.
And so over the years, we've just been adding, as you very well heard at the beginning of the show, all my little.
I loved that. Yeah, it was so much fun.
So over all these years, when it comes to the products that you've developed, tell me a little bit about the spread of, shirts and hoodies and pants. Like what are the different products that you've developed and offered through Vital Hemp, and what are you focused on offering these days?
Well, I just want to finish up the last point a little bit and to say
sure.
that the project of Hemptication was
yes.
always a big part of Vital Hemp.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I really enjoyed doing was writing the newsletters, but I really enjoyed it when the Venice Boardwalk drew a lot of people from all over the world, and so did my store in Santa Monica. And a lot of people were just curious. They didn't really know what hemp was. And so because I knew a lot more and continued to learn, I was able to tell them everything from the difference between hemp and marijuana in terms of how it grows, in terms of the THC content, in terms of the different uses. I was able to tell them about all the different uses of hemp, both historically and currently, turn them on to the ideas of hemp bioplastic, hemp building materials, and then put them in a hemp shirt and tell them about the benefits of hemp fabrics, both from the antimicrobial perspective and the breathing, the durability, the way it wears in. It was fun coming up with metaphors like people that I told you about, the hemp won't get you high, but these clothes will raise your spirits. I had another one that I came up with, which is like, hemp is like, it's like canines. Not all canines are the same. The golden retriever can be your best friend, and the wolf, which also has a valuable place in the ecosystem, but if you encounter it, it could bite you. And so in the same way, you might, if you were to just discover marijuana for the first time and ingest a bunch of it, you might get really, way too stoned. But hemp t-shirt could be your favorite t-shirt in your wardrobe. Anyway, that's just on that. Now, in terms of what we've made in the past, when I first started on the boardwalk, I was buying t-shirts that Barbara Filippone designed and had made in one of the factories she worked with in China. And they were very standard cuts. They were pretty standard colors, black, white. I believe there was a navy blue and possibly a burgundy and maybe an olive. And those were good. I was selling them for $30 a piece. I think I bought them for 15 or something like that. And, it was an okay business. It was challenging. I wasn't getting rich on it at all. I don't even know if I was making a profit after all, but I didn't really pay myself much in those days or ever. But eventually I used the contact that I had through my short-lived partnership with Jeff to travel to China and even before I traveled there, to just start becoming a designer of things that I wanted to make. So if I wanted to make a long sleeve, I would buy a Patagonia long sleeve and send it to China and say, please make this in this specific hemp tensile knit that I was using. And they would make it. And then I would, work with a pattern maker here and say, okay, I want the sleeves a little bit narrower than how they came out, and I want the body a little narrower and or a little longer, or and I would send notes back with drawings to China, and then they'd say, okay, we got it, and then I would I'd wire $20,000 or whatever it was as the first payment, and then another 20 later, and then cross my fingers. And then all these boxes would come in, you know, filled with hemp clothing, whether it was t-shirts or hoodies or long sleeves or later pants or skirts. And I would, you know, unfurl the boxes, and they were all colors that I had chose from, you know, Pantone charts based on things that I wanted to see in the world, and, you know, usually inspired by nature. And I had a lot of fun with contrast stitching and back in those days. And, you know, I experiment, like this shirt that I'm wearing is probably from that old time. I mean, can you believe it? This shirt's probably 10 years old at least. It's an aqua shirt within the contrast stitching, a flat lock stitch. I mean, this one was made in LA, but yeah, this is one of my aqua shirts
I'm wearing.
So my idea was to create fashionable basics so that we could replace the polluting cotton that was really polluting ecosystems and leading to farmers in places like India killing themselves because they couldn't maintain their livelihoods with the expenses of the pesticides, and then the pesticides would blow off into the rivers and there would be health problems among their wives and birth defects, and the fish would be born with three eyes and all sorts of problems. I remember listening to a presentation by the head of Women's Health Organization, the International Women's Health Organization, at one of the business conferences up in San Francisco, and it brought tears to my eyes. And I thought, you know, if hemp can alleviate some of the suffering and help clear up some of these polluted ecosystems that are being polluted because of cotton, then we're doing a good job.
And which actually ties into my next question. You already touched upon it, which is, you know, why is hemp so much better than other fabrics? Why should more people be wearing hemp fabric clothing?
Well, I think it's better on a micro level and on a macro level. On the micro level, I've touched on the fact that, you know, it's the most breathable natural fiber, really well. I wear it as a base layer when I'm skiing. I also wear it as when I'm in the hot, humid tropics. And I've had people from mountain climbers to surfers give me, you know, phenomenal feedback. Like, hey, I love this. I was down in Ecuador. It performed so well. Or I'm in Bali. I wear your stuff all the time. Or I've had, you know, rock climbers say I was in Joshua Tree in winter, stuck up on a face overnight, and I was so happy that I was wearing your Vital Hemp hoodie. Or, you know, things like that. Or people coming back from Tibet saying, like, I was holed up in a cave and all I had given away all my belongings, and all one of the only pieces I had was your Vital Hemp hoodie, and I was so happy. Oh, you know, I mean, these stories sometimes bring tears to my own eyes. But so that's the micro level. The macro level is that, unlike cotton that is pesticide intensive, except for organic cotton, but that accounts for such a tiny little part overall cotton production in the world, hemp is largely grown all over the world without pesticides because it's just naturally pest resistant. It also uses a lot less water than cotton cultivation, both in the growing of it, but also, and more importantly, in the care of the garments. For example, when I wear a pair of pants, if it's a pair of cotton pants, typically I'll wash that pair of pants, you know, after I wear it, because it will have absorbed a bunch of sweat and it just doesn't feel clean anymore. I can wear my hemp anywhere, my pants, which I think you've probably had a pair or two in your lifetime. I can wear those three, four times before putting them in the laundry. They're made out of 100% hemp linen. They breathe. They don't absorb perspiration. They wick moisture away from the skin, and they stay fresh longer. So, you know, I'm saving 3 to 4 washes every time I wear that. Same with t-shirts. If I was wearing a cotton t-shirt, every day I would have to wash that or put it in the laundry. I can wear a hemp t-shirt 2 times. It's second day, it's still fresh. I mean, unless I'm like running up a hillside, but for everyday use, yeah, you can wear a t-shirt or you're having the water usage of that. Mm-hmm. The life of the garment, that adds up over millions of people, that adds up. So there's that. Then I learned about the most important thing with respect to global warming, which is the way in which the hemp crop sequesters atmospheric carbon. For every ton that we harvest, it sequesters 1.62 tons of atmospheric carbon, which means it's a carbon. Some of that carbon that it brings out of the atmosphere goes into the soil, into the fibers of the plant, the roots, root systems, and the actual matter of the plant. So it gets turned into products, whether it's clothing, food, building materials, etc. And I felt really, really good about that back to Patagonia, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Those are a couple of reasons. How's that?
Is that okay? Oh, more than enough. Yeah. I mean, it's very clear to me that there's far more reasons to wear hemp than any other type of fiber. So to kind of shift gears here and sure. get more into the hemptrepreneurial aspect of your life. It's sure. not easy being an entrepreneur, let alone a hemptrepreneur. There's right. more challenges, there's more struggles, there's more things I think that get in the way for somebody to be delving into a hemp business. And so in your experience, what would you say are some of the biggest challenges that you've had to face as a hemptrepreneur, and how have you been able to overcome some of those things?
Well, I think like many people, we go in from, because we're idealists and because we care about this world and we want to do something tangible. We don't just want to go. I would have never gone into apparel if it wasn't for hemp. I really didn't care that much about clothing. I was still wearing God from Ross dress for less, or from an estate sale on the side of the road, or stuff that I was still wearing in college because my body hadn't changed that much. So, you know, to me, as long as it was comfortable, I didn't need it to be fashionable. And I really didn't care about fashion. I never looked at fashion magazines. I still don't. It was because of hemp that I got into it. And I think that's what draws a lot of entrepreneurs or people in to become entrepreneurs, to become hemppreneurs in the hemp world. So what is it that are the unique challenges? I think that one of the unique challenges is that it draws a lot of people who don't have necessarily a lot of business experience. I did not have business experience. I did not go to business school. I've never taken a business class. I didn't even know how important marketing was until probably 10 years in, no, probably 7 years into running my business when I opened my store on Main Street.
Okay. So of all your years marketing your products in the hemp industry, what would you say are some of the biggest challenges that you've had in this industry and marketing and selling hemp products, and how have you been able to overcome some of those challenges?
Right. So as I think I said before, the challenges were at the beginning largely because of my background, or I should say lack of background in business. I didn't even realize until probably 6 years into the business that it made sense for me to put money into marketing. I was just putting money into product and refining product, and you know, occasionally I would go to a festival or a show, and in my mind I didn't even think of those places as marketing opportunities. I was just there to sell. And I did eventually create a website, and I did start my newsletters a long time ago. So in some sense, that was marketing. It was marketing. Had I, back in, let's say, 2005 or even 2010, had I decided to put more money into such things as Facebook ads and understand that world, I think, or even Google AdWords, which later I discovered, maybe 2015, around then, I started to put some money into Facebook ads, some money into Google AdWords. I also never really understood or devoted myself to affiliate marketing, which would have been another really good opportunity for Vital Hemp, because I have lots of allies in the world. And I think that they would have been happy to make a little money by turning other people on to Vital Hemp stuff. So in a way, I think it just had to do with inertia and just going with where I was strong, which, and where I wanted to spend my time, which was working with the designer, other designers, cutters, sewers, fit models, pattern makers, dye houses, all of that, you know, all of the people associated with production, and then writing my newsletters, which I can do and love to do just because it's comes, that's my strength. And being out on the road, either being in the shop or being out on the road at festivals or expos and so forth, where I'm actually meeting with and interacting with my customers and helping them out. So I think that was been my biggest challenge, was when I did eventually understand that my business could really flourish much better if I were to devote some of my resources towards marketing, I ended up hiring a series over the years of, you know, probably starting in 2015 or so till 2020, a series of digital marketing agencies who just let me down one after another. They would get me on a monthly retainer. You know, the salesperson who initially I spoke with knew his stuff impeccably. And I thought, okay, finally, someone who gets what I want to do. They're saying all the right things. I'm asking all the right questions. They're telling me all the right answers. And then I sign up and then I'm paying, you know, whatever, $3,000 a month and getting some college 19-year-old college graduate in Florida or Mexico who's like writing these stupid, thank God it's Friday, you know, memes, which are ridiculous and full of grammatical errors. And anyway, I can't times I went through that stuff and no accountability, no increase in sales, just money out the door over and over again. Not entirely true with the one foray I did into Google AdWords. I did get some benefit from that. I may have gotten some benefit from the few times that I myself paid for some Facebook ads, but it would have been really good, I think, to have someone trustworthy and knowledgeable for me, or to maybe bring someone in-house to do that. I just never found the right people to do it for me.
Well, what did you find to be some of the most like effective ways of getting sales? I know from what you've shared with me and from who I know you to be and how you operate, word of mouth is like probably foundational. People wear your clothing and are pretty much walking billboards for Vital Hemp, and then they tell their friends and it kind of spreads. But is there anything beyond that that you're...
I don't even know if word of mouth is number one. I think it's repeat business. I think that I have an email list of 7,500 people or so. And I venture to guess that every single one of those people, well, no, not every single one, but probably 6,000 out of those 7,500 are actually customers who've bought something at one time or another over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And right. So when I send
email marketing is a big thing for you.
When I send a newsletter out, I usually get a flurry of orders.
Nice.
For whatever reason, I had it in my mind that I should send out a monthly newsletter. So I've really only been sending out monthly newsletters. Some other companies I see, they're sending out 2 to 3 newsletters, maybe not newsletters, but 2 to 3 email marketing this or that a week.
Yeah.
So they're really benefiting from that. For whatever reason, didn't do that, even though that would have been a smart move.
Yeah. It's not too late.
And it's not too late. And, you know, I'm in a point of transition in a way, because I'm not sure how Vital Hemp's been a bit in hibernation since we closed the store at the beginning of the pandemic. And I've not really produced anything since the beginning of the pandemic. I've just been selling off existing inventory, and inventory levels are very low right now. I mean, and I just got very tired of running the business all by myself. When I say that, I mean, I've always had people working with me, but I've always been the one in the C-level making those decisions, whether it was CEO, CTO, CFO, CMO, blah, 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 technology. I mean, making decisions that I wasn't actually that qualified to make. And the few times when I did hire someone to take over those hats, they might work for a while and help me make some good decisions. And then, you know,
for whatever reason, they might leave or I might let them go. And then I would be left with sometimes with systems I didn't understand, sometimes with systems that were half made, sometimes with systems that didn't integrate with other systems and so forth.
So you're saying marketing for you has at the core been repeat business, sending out your monthly newsletter, word of mouth.
Showing up at events. I mean,
live events.
And also what's interesting is that I had a pretty decent business. Part of my business was making custom orders for other companies. So whether that was early on, raw food restaurant called Leaf Cuisine. My friend Rod loved my shirts. He's like, hey, we need shirts for our team and our customers. And so I think he might have been my first custom order customer. He chose the color. He had a new logo. I made it. I took it downtown. I had it printed, blah, blah, blah. That was first one. Next one might have been, early one was John Rulak from Nutiva. And that was a big order, 1,000 shirts, men's and women's, and two colors with his logos and even a little side patch here, logo on the back side patch here. Those turned out great. He loved them. His people loved them. And when you have 1,000 people getting shirts, right, that's 1,000 people going, oh, I love this shirt. Wow, Vital Hemp, huh? Okay, yeah, let me go online. Oh, okay, I'm going to order another one. So that's kind of like, I don't know how long it would take me to sell 1,000 pieces if I was at a booth.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know how long it would take you to sell.
I don't know how long it would take me. Even in the store, it might just to sell 1,000 pieces. It might have taken 3 months to sell 1,000 pieces, or a month or 2 months. I don't know exactly. But to get a single order where it's 1,000 pieces, and then you have 1,000 customers who bought, each of them will likely fall in love with that piece, and then maybe might want to get more. So it's kind of a very good model, I think, for me to grow the business if I want to jump back in and grow it with the
more
middle amount.
B2B wholesale focus.
Yeah, especially like custom order, not even wholesale, because the
just
wholesale
custom
business is tough. You know, wholesale owners, especially of boutiques, they're operating with limited budgets. They want to place limited orders targeted to their customers, and they're very finicky. Like they get something and it does, oh, can I return this? Can I this? Okay, Mike, they want everything at wholesale. So you're not making the margins. Plus, you're dealing with someone who's as finicky, if not more finicky, than your average retail customer. So it just depends on me. I did it for many, many years. I love my wholesale customers, and I loved the fact that there was someone in from Mexico to Seattle. There were stores selling my stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the East Coast and all over. I loved that. And I loved visiting those stores and meeting the owners and supporting them as best I could. From a business perspective, it wasn't the easiest for me to do. And then sometimes, a lot of times, I wasn't just able to satisfy them. It's like they'd be like, oh, we want more men's long sleeves. And I'd be like, well, I don't have enough men's long sleeves to give you a full size run in the colors you want. All I have is enough maybe for my store. And even then, I'm running low.
Mm-hmm.
So
hard to keep up with it all.
Yeah. So I think it would have been better had I had maybe a wholesale sales manager who was really good. And I did at times have people who were devoted to wholesale. And I had, at one time I had road reps and I had people who were supposedly representing the brand. And the idea was to create enough pre-orders and aggregate those pre-orders so that, and even get deposits on the pre-orders so that then, and I did this successfully kind of near the beginning, starting in around 2005. I was doing that even when I was getting Chinese goods, because it was allowing me to fund the production. I would take 50% deposit. I'd let people know what I was ordering. They'd order. I'd take 50% deposit. Then the stuff would come in. I would ship it out and collect the second 50% before shipping, actually, including shipping.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good model.
Yeah.
I just, you know, anyway, with this, I think at a certain point, I was probably doing too many things. I was doing the store, wholesale, custom orders, and e-commerce, and festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just too many things. I was one guy. I was self-funding it. And yeah,
makes
it was
sense.
Sort of a recipe for a little bit of, it
burnout.
Yeah, a little burnout, and also just not being able to look at all of these activities that I was doing and be with a very cold analytical eye,
mm-hmm.
look at the numbers and go, okay, does it really make sense to be doing wholesale? Does it really make sense to be going to this festival considering the cost?
Yeah. You think maybe as like a word of advice to other hemp entrepreneurs, you would say maybe pick one area of a business and hone in and focus your energy so that you can really ignite that one aspect of it rather than trying to do 10 different things?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. For sure. I mean, mm-hmm. it's very tempting because, you know, you want to be able to serve people online. You want to be able to serve people if they're going to a store. You want to be able to serve people if they're going to an expo or if they want custom orders. But unless you have the staff to help you manage and integrate all of those different sectors of your business into one model and to coldly assess like what's performing, what's not, and then to make decisions based on those things. Same with, I mean, I'm an optimist, right? So I like to try new things. So I always thought, well, maybe doing the wholesale will eventually grow their business too, and then they'll order more the next time.
Mm-hmm.
Or in terms of production, maybe it would have been better for me to stick to t-shirts and hoodies and pants for a while before venturing into long dresses and short dresses and, you know, whatever, beanies and hempkins and everything else that I did.
Yeah, what I call it chasing all the
Henleys, button downs, long sleeve, short sleeve, shorts. I mean, you name it, right?
Yeah.
And there were many, many, many more things that I wanted to do that customers were asking for, any one of which could have been a success. But the problem is that when you spread yourself too thin, as I did, and you don't have the resources to thicken the ice, so to speak, to support you, you can fall through. There's some mm-hmm. thin areas, and then they become kind of dangerous areas. Like, oh, well, is mm-hmm. this whole thing is just going to cave in, or what do I do now? I got to, you know, I can't mm-hmm. really support this area anymore because it's too thin. I can't support that area anymore; it's too thin. So, got to skate over to the thick areas, you know.
Yeah. I call it the for hemp entrepreneurs, it's the curse of too many hemp opportunities.
That's there you go. There you go.
To kind of shift gears here, I just have a few more questions.
Sure.
So I first of all really appreciate you and everything that you've done in the industry. And I want to kind of focus in specifically on Vital Hemp products and what makes them unique, what makes them different from other hemp clothing products on the market. What is different about your products and what makes them unique?
Initially, my vision for the brand was to create stylish, comfortable, affordable hemp clothing and ultimately made in the USA. So I think that the first distinguishing feature from some brands is that some brands are still made overseas. Many have returned home, and I'm happy about that. But we've, ever since 2010, we've been manufacturing here in LA. And I'm the designer, in effect, and I have been since the beginning. Since the beginning when I started designing, not in the first couple of years when I was just selling other people's stuff. But for the last 18 years, I've been the designer. And I've worked with family-owned businesses in Los Angeles. And I've always attempted to source the very, very best quality materials and to work with the very, very best contractors. And it took me a while to find those. For example, if the knits that I was getting were shrinking too much or would develop holes or whatever it was, I would switch and I would find a different manufacturer. And ultimately, I ended up making my knits in LA, like actually from yarn. I found somewhere that could just import the yarn. We'd make the fabric in LA. And it's a really, really, and so it's so stable and so good. I took probably like a 4-mile hike today. I'm still wearing the shirt and it doesn't even smell because it was wicking the whole time. And hemp has these great antimicrobial qualities. So there's that. Best sewer, best dye house, best cutters, finishing, all of that. I really have, when I made my Anywhere pants, I used American-made thread. Who uses American-made thread? No one, I guarantee you, uses American-made thread because it's so much more expensive than the Chinese-made thread or thread made anywhere else in the world. I tried to minimize the use of plastic. Like, I never went into the recycled plastic blends. I just think plastic, there's a myth that plastic is recyclable. Most of it, above 90% of it, never gets recycled. Mm-hmm. And because people think that it can be recycled, it just gives permission to make more and more things out of plastic. Oh, I'll just recycle these bottles. I'll recycle these containers. I'll recycle. And it just ends up going into landfill, eventually gets into the ocean, but everywhere else. And it's horrible. It's just clogging up the arteries of the planet and the lungs of the planet, and the ocean being one of the major ones. And very harmful. So I never wanted to participate in the plastic thing. I don't even think recycled plastic's a good solution at all. You know, maybe if they're taking stuff out of the oceans and then recycling that, fine. But any new product, recycling, forget it. Just let's not make it. Let's go to a zero plastic model of mm-hmm. manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Unless that plastic is made with biomass
mm-hmm.
or polymers. I know that's not right on the horizon, but we're there. We're getting close. Okay. Second thing is, I was one of the first people to just really invest in 100% hemp stuff. I'm not saying I'm the first. I mean, the company that came before me, Juice Naturale, they had a lot of heavier 100% shirts and some 100% pants made in China. I really liked using the 100% hemp linen fabric for my shirting and pants. And I just think it's such a great fabric. And people have loved my Anywhere pants, both the men's Anywhere pants and the women's Anywhere pants, for decades now. So I just keep making them when I can. I'm totally out of the men's ones except for small and double extra large. But I have women's still in most size runs, in most of the sizes, in most of the colors, not all at this point. But yeah, and I would use YKK zippers because I knew they were the best. I would use either coconut or Caruso buttons because coconut's a natural product and Caruso is a shell. Is Caruso a nut? I think Caruso is a nut, actually. So again, just reducing plastic, using the best quality, what else?
I know one thing.
What? Oh, the colors.
Yeah, the colors is definitely unique. You're using hemp and tencel. You're blending
not
with...
Before. No, no.
Not anymore.
I used hemp. I was one of the early ones. I mean, Barbara developed that fabric.
Like your knit fabrics, the jersey knit, is that a hemp and organic cotton or what is it?
Hemp and organic cotton.
Okay, yeah. Nice.
It's a hemp and organic cotton. It's a 55-45. It's a really nice weight. Mm-hmm. I garment dye everything rather than piece dyeing. So everything is pre-shrunk.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time with fit. You know, people really like my fits, I can't tell you when I wanted to make a wrap dress, I probably went through so many iterations of that wrap dress till I got it just right. And then I people loved it and I sold out. I maybe made it one more time after that. I don't know why I didn't continue making it. I guess it's just bandwidth. Maybe I didn't have enough money to fund production at that point for more. But yeah, I really, really concentrate on fit. I mean, my background, as I mentioned to you, is in writing and literature. And in this, I put as much care into the fit, into sort of nailing the fit of things as I do with making sure that, you know, I've proofread an essay that I'm going to put in the world or something like that. Yeah, there are times when where there are surprises, and you know, maybe the sleeves come out too long because the shrink test was different than what ultimately happened in production. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've had to adjust. Sometimes I've had to shorten sleeves, or sometimes I've had to somehow make things work, or size down, or do something. Rarely, but it happens. Not everything is perfect.
Yeah,
I'm more proud of certain styles than I am of others. I made a hemp Henley a couple years ago, and I thought, oh, this is going to be so cool. It's a Henley hoodie, and mm-hmm. it's got the buttons. It ended up a little boxier than I would have liked and a little shorter than I would have liked. I still wear it. There's still mm-hmm. people who love it and mm-hmm. buy it. but it wasn't like one of those, like the regular hoodie where people just, where I sell out very quickly because that's a staple that people just want.
Yeah.
You know, and they want it in every color. They want, I mean, I have people who are constantly saying, well, oh, can you bring this back? Oh, can you bring that back? Oh, can you make more of these? And let me know when this is available again. And, you know, on the one hand, I really want to make more. On the other hand, I just am at a point where unless someone wants to come in with resources and know-how, particularly maybe marketing know-how, e-commerce know-how, to build the business, I'm just not inclined to jump in by myself again.
Those are all unique, you know, differentiators with your products. That was, you know, what I was looking
colors.
For.
I mean, I think people have over the years told me that the colors are so unique and really make them feel good. And I think it's because I choose the colors both with my eyes and like with my heart and my whole body. Like I literally will just look at colors and say, how does this make me feel? And then I'll just like let the vibration of the color create a feeling in me.
Yeah.
And when I have the feeling that I feel good about, then I'll choose that color.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, man, I'm just coming up to the kind of the end here, but I have a couple questions left for you.
Sure. Okay.
And this one is more related to hemp in general and the history of hemp. I'm curious, do you have like a couple of hemp fun facts that you keep in the back of your pocket when anybody doesn't know the history of hemp and how embedded and woven into the fabric of our history it is? Is there a couple, like a handful of hemp fun facts that you like to share?
Yeah, many, many, many.
I bet.
Of the fact that hemp has been used for paper for thousands of years, and that the Gutenberg Bible was written on hemp, and the Mark Twain were published on hemp. Abraham Lincoln wrote his speeches on hemp. The early drafts of the Constitution, all drafts except the final one, were written on hemp paper. Benjamin Franklin, with the works of Lewis Carroll, also hemp. Benjamin Franklin's first printing press employed hemp paper. And I just feel like hemp is so intertwined with our history and the history of the world. And people, you know, who don't know much about it think, oh, hemp is marijuana. But once you start to introduce them to the many varieties and features, not varieties, but the many uses of hemp, they kind of go, oh, wow, really? I never knew that. I love also talking about hempcrete and, you know, Dion Margraff and his work and that moment when he was at Earth Day down in San Diego with that little demonstration hemp house and his blowtorch. And like, you know, 3 inches away from a hemp house with a blowtorch, and the thing would not ignite. And all it might do is it's a little circle of carbon that was, you know, not even burning, but just getting hot. And knowing from documentaries I've watched and from reading that this is the healthiest possible building material, fire resistant, mold resistant, super insulative in terms of regulating temperature. And I remember learning about this beer holding facility in like Scotland or somewhere that reduced its annual electricity bill for cooling the beer, keeping the beer cool, by something like 40% when they changed one of the buildings to hemp. And then how versatile it is, from building a small structure on your own property to building the second largest Marks and Spencer department store in all of the UK in modern curves and with like stucco, smooth stucco exterior, to the point where you're like, wow, I had no idea this was hempcrete. So that's another one. The other is that hemp bioplastic is being used by many of the major car manufacturers for the interior body panels of their cars, whether it's BMW, Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, They're all using hemp bioplastic, especially in their high-end cars, because it's stronger, lighter, more durable, more flame resistant, more mold resistant, and it doesn't off-gas the way that petroleum-based plastics do. It doesn't get misshapen with heat. And at the end of its useful life, it can be composted. So, I mean, it's just such a win on so many levels. And I'm buoyed by the fact that the car industry is recognizing hemp as a useful material for body panels. I wish that we had never stopped using hemp bioplastic for the exterior body panels as well.
Yeah.
As Henry Ford did. And see if they're interested in that YouTube video, Henry Ford hemp car, and watch him use a sledgehammer on the back fender of one of his models, and watch the sledgehammer literally bounce off the exterior body panel of the car. I mean, can you imagine how much money we would have saved in auto body costs by having lightweight, super dent resistant hemp bioplastic be the shell of our cars? But then car companies wouldn't have made money and sold more vehicles, and you know, the whole auto industry, body shop industry, probably would have just been something else.
Mm-hmm.
So those Absolutely. Are some fun facts that I like to trot out here.
Those are awesome. Yeah, that's more robust, I think, than any other hemptrepreneur I've had on the show. You definitely know your hempstery, as we say.
Yeah.
So my last two questions are, number one, how can people learn more about Vital Hemp? Where can they find you? I know you said you don't have your physical store, but you definitely have your website. How can people order some of your products and learn more about what you're up to on the socials and all of that?
Yeah, vitalhemp.com is the website. If they want to keep up with what's happening with the company, just sign up for the newsletter. And at least once a month, I hope to let you know what's going on. If there are any potential investors or partners out there who want to resources and know-how and believe in the mission and believe they can help scale it, I'm open to having conversations. And you can just shoot me an email through the website. We do have an Instagram page. I don't think it's super active. Well, I think we post a little bit more on Facebook. Those are basically the ways people can find me. But if they want to buy something from what we have left at this point, find us on vitalhemp.com. Any more?
So my final question is, imagine you were standing on a world stage and you were literally addressing every human being on the planet, and you could, within 60 seconds, share one message with them, and it could be about hemp or it could be about anything at all. What would you want every human being in the world to know?
I would want everybody to know that we live on an absolute miracle jewel of a planet that is abundant, resourceful, marvelous beyond our imagination to even comprehend. And it has everything here for us to live fruitfully, to live in peace and abundance, in harmony with all the other species with whom we share this planet. And I would like everybody to know that as a goal for humanity to continue to keep this planet vital, not just for us, but for all of the species that have as much right to be here as we do, that we think about how we can support these other species in their native ecosystems, whether that's hemp as a crop that serves beyond humans, birds, and enormous amounts of other species, or whether it's dolphins or insects or you name it. They are all, or algae or plankton or coral, they are all part of this interconnected world in which we live, and that we as stewards and sort of high on the totem pole of consciousness and also high on the totem pole of potential and real destruction that we're causing, I believe we have a responsibility to respect the other life forms, to better understand how we are all related, and to learn how we can support the myriad life forms to work together in holistic ways to create abundance and peace and harmony for all the living beings on Earth. And this will require some people earning less money, perhaps, exploiting people less, but it will ultimately be a much, much happier future and one that is around for our children and grandchildren and for many generations, as at least seven, as our Native American brothers and sisters remind us, is to try to keep that vision in mind. And so I would say that's my message, Tyler.
Amen. Well, I appreciate that. It's right in alignment with a book that I'm looking to publish early 2024. It's a working title, but the title is something like How Hemp Pays for Peace, and using this as our vehicle for creating more peace on Earth. And I get that we may never get to a point where there's no wars and there's no destruction and fighting. Like, there's probably always going to be some level of that. But if we can create a deeper sense of health and wealth and true harmonious abundance with hemp as our vehicle, I do believe that we all, as a human family and all species, like you were saying, can experience more harmony and more peace as a result of hemp being at the center of what we're doing. So that's why you and I do what we do. And I really appreciate your insights and your wisdom and the experience that you've brought to this industry, and appreciate you being on this hempisode of Hemp Aware Radio.
Yeah, Tyler, thank you so much for hosting me. And it's always good to hear from you and see you and to just witness your evolution from the kid in the alley who was helping me unload my van after a hard day's work and teaching me about heart-to-heart hugs, and lesson that I decided to adopt probably 18 or so years ago, and have given thousands of heart-to-heart hugs since then. And I owe that to you, and I think it's a testament to your big heart. You shared that with me, and just know that that legacy continues through me into the world. So thanks for bringing the love, brother.
It's an honor and a privilege. Thank you so much. I appreciate you all tuning in to another hempisode of Hemp Aware Radio. This is your hemp entrepreneurial host, Tyler Hemp, here to hemp power and hemp educate your hemposphere. We'll see you on the next hempisode. Thanks everyone for tuning in.